WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Nancy Solomon, managing editor of New Jersey Public Radio, filling in for Brian, who is on vacation. President Trump is expected to announce his pick for the Supreme Court justice to replace the retiring Anthony Kennedy at 9 o'clock tonight. Trump indicated yesterday he still has four people on his shortlist. Joining me now to discuss the potential judges under consideration and the enormous change this will certainly bring to the highest court is Jamie Floyd, WNYC's host for All Things Considered and our in-house legal analyst. Good morning, Jamie.
Hello, Nancy.
Let's start with the retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. He took conservative positions on some rulings, Citizens United, Bush v. Gore, but also quite progressive stances in others, same-sex marriage, for which he wrote the majority opinion.
Yeah.
Was Kennedy unpredictable, or do we think of conservative-liberal divides too narrowly, and was there a consistency to his legal analysis?
Yeah, he was a conservative. He was consistently a conservative. And yes, he was at the fulcrum of, as Adam Liptak put it over the weekend, the center of what would have been otherwise a conservative court, but he's a conservative. And so we are all looking at him as a liberal, a libertarian thinker who is leaving the court and will certainly be replaced by a very conservative pick by President Trump, and we'll talk in a moment about who the choices are, and the court will shift very much to the right. But we shouldn't look back with rose-colored glasses on Kennedy's time on the bench. He was more liberal than I think many very conservative thinkers would have liked, especially when looking at LGBTQ rights. He took, I think, what was for him a very thoughtful and independent stance on some, because he had a lifetime appointment and he could, on some positions. But if you look at this last term, he sided with the conservatives every single time. He sided with the liberals zero times. And Adam Liptak ran the numbers. Zero times did he side with the liberals. Justice Roberts sided with the liberals a couple of times. Believe it or not, Alito sided with the liberals one time. So Justice Gorsuch sided with the liberals one time. Justice Kennedy, zero times. So he really was a conservative justice, though because of some personal experiences and because of a slight libertarian streak, on some issues, he could take an independent view, or what some would call a libertarian view. And very specifically, we do think about the gay rights decisions. He also, on First Amendment cases, could be very independent, but then on Citizens United, he then took a First Amendment point of view, and that turned out to be a very conservative, many people would see it as a very conservative opinion. So I see him as a conservative justice.
Well, that may explain my next question a little bit, because I think, you know, and people that I've run into who were wringing their hands about their fears of a Trump nomination.
Yeah.
That one of the things people say a lot is that they can't believe that Kennedy would relinquish this choice to
sure.
Trump. And then, so we had the piece in the New York Times, maybe it was Friday or over the weekend, about the courting that the Trump administration
mm-hmm.
did
mm-hmm.
to convince Kennedy that Trump could be trusted with his replacement.
Right.
And I found that really astounding, this idea that
Gorsuch was chosen because he was a Kennedy clerk.
Yeah.
And that federal judges are being put on the lower courts because they were Kennedy clerks, and that there was a whole
campaign
to do this. That was just astounding to me.
Yeah, well, it has been reported and somewhat verified that Justice Kennedy's clerks are on the lower court, so that's a fact. And whether or not that affected Justice Kennedy's opinion, decision to resign at this time, we will perhaps never know. But let's just look back at who Justice Kennedy is. He is from a very powerful and well-established conservative Republican family in California. His father was a Republican, well-rooted Republican attorney in California. That's who he is. His son is a very successful and conservative attorney businessman connected to the Trump sons. That doesn't mean that he's a Trump Republican, but these are not progressive people. He, I think, would want to be assured that the court would be left in good hands, that I think he's an institutionalist. We hear that phrase used a lot about Justice Roberts, but I think Justice Kennedy cares about the institution of the court. So he wants to know that a very well-heeled, well-established justice is going to be put in place, not a radical wingnut. And Justice Gorsuch, whatever you think of his politics or his jurisprudence, is clearly a well-established jurist. And so you got Justice Gorsuch. I think spending that year with Justice Gorsuch probably reassured him. And now two of the people on the short list are former Kennedy clerks. And as you point out, Nancy, seated throughout the judiciary, and people don't pay enough attention to the impact President Trump has had on the judiciary, but seated throughout the judiciary are Kennedy clerks. And that may or may not have had an impact on his decision to retire. He is also 81 years old. He is very much a family man. His wife has had some health problems. So there are other things that go into a person's decision whether or not to retire. Is he going to wait another 2.5 years to see who the next president is going to be? And that person may also be a Republican or may not be. I don't know how much those go into people's decision. You know, that's a lot of time for someone who's 81 years old.
Yeah, I don't think anyone was particularly suggesting 2 or 3 years, but the midterms and the Russian investigation are what comes up over and over.
Right, but what happens at the midterms? The Democrats might. First of all, he's a Republican. Let's remember, he's a Republican. But let's say the Democrats take the Senate. President Trump still makes the nomination, right? It's the same short list of judges put forward by the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation. So we're still looking at Hardiman and Coney Barrett and Kavanaugh, all the people we're about to talk about, the same people who were on the short list when Gorsuch was nominated. It's the same group of judges, the same former Kennedy clerks. Not much changes because you've still got either President Trump or President Pence, or it's the same short list of Federalist Society judges. I keep hearing this conversation about the midterms, but what really changes at that point, really?
Well, the Democrats would have a lot more say in this process if they were, I mean, look what happened with Merrick Garland. They would have a lot more say in the process if they were the party that controlled the advice and consent role.
But that was a presidential election shift. This would just be a shift in the Senate. You'd still have the same president making the nomination of the justice. And even if this impeachment conversation I keep hearing about, let's say somehow you'd have an impeachment of President Trump by 2020, which, you know, that's a whole other conversation for another day, and President Pence took over, you'd still have the nomination of the next person on the same shortlist that we're talking about, and the same advice and consent by the same Senate. You're not going to stall this process out for 4 years. No. Sorry, folks.
I'm Nancy Solomon, managing editor for New Jersey Public Radio, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with WNYC's Jamie Floyd. She's the host of All Things Considered and our resident legal analyst. Listeners, what questions do you have about the nomination process for the upcoming vacancy on the Supreme Court? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. So let's talk about this list of four and who they are and what you know about them.
Yeah, well, the person who is supposedly, though I don't really believe he is, but supposedly at the top of the list is Raymond Kethledge. It's Brett Kavanaugh. Brett Kavanaugh is supposed, Kethledge is the person I think has the best shot. It's, spoiler alert, spoiler alert. It's Brett Kavanaugh, who everyone says is at the top of the list. He is a former Kennedy clerk. He has checked all the boxes. He is on the D.C. Circuit, which is considered to be the feeder court to the Supreme Court. He was on the short list before. He is a Bush appointee. He has served in the Department of Justice. He was on the Starr committee that investigated President Clinton. And this is the thing that people say Trump must love. He has, as a result of that experience, said, I really don't think we should be investigating presidents because it takes too much time and distraction away from their good work as presidents. After the fact, of course, he says, they can then be investigated. But while they're presidents, they shouldn't have civil lawsuits, they shouldn't have criminal investigations, or at least we should limit the amount of investigation we do of them while they're in office.
Well, and this issue very well might come to the Supreme Court. Right?
Yes, yes. And his quote is, I believe the president should be excised from some of the burdens of ordinary citizenship while serving in office. And this was responding to civil lawsuits and criminal charges based on his experience in working with Ken Starr on the Monica Lewinsky business. I think that's a fair, he's been through it. He's seen it up close. I think that's probably a fair assessment. And many people are speculating that this is something that might appeal to President Trump. The reason I think he's at the top of the list, this is the reportage. The reason I tend to think he's not going to get it, and of course now I'm going out on a limb, Nancy.
I love it.
Because of course at 9 o'clock tonight, I'll be proved wrong. But first of all, he's 53. I don't think age is as big an issue as everybody's making it out to be, because three of the people on this list are 53. The young person is 46, so that's a 7-year difference. But he is a little too much of an establishment guy. He's, first of all, an Ivy Leaguer. The other three people are not. I think President Trump may prefer to put a non-Ivy Leaguer on the court. We've got a bunch of Ivy Leaguers up there. The one thing Trump has said he wants to do is just drain the swamp. Well, let's drain it at the Supreme Court and put let's tip the balance. Let's put a little diversity on the court in terms of a non-Ivy Leaguer. How about that kind of diversity? I could actually get behind that. How about somebody who went to Notre Dame, as we say, instead of Harvard, Yale, which is what we have up there. Right now, it's Harvard and Yale, and that's it, Nancy. Can you believe it? We don't even have Stanford. We used to have Justice O'Connor, who went to Stanford and brought a little West Coast diversity. So it would be, if he goes up there, it's just another Ivy Leaguer. But also, he's a D.C. guy. So he's kind of a Washington insider. So I'm thinking maybe not Kavanaugh. He's also very tied in with the Bushes. And that's another thing that I think maybe President Trump won't be so excited about. He might prefer to go with one of the others.
And what about Hardiman?
Well, Hardiman is...
That's Thomas Hardiman.
Thomas Hardiman, and he's appealing for a lot of reasons. He's also 53 years old. He was the runner-up last year when Neil Gorsuch was picked in the Scalia spot. He is these are all, it goes without saying, solidly conservative people, but some are sort of establishment conservative. We'll get to the woman in a minute. She is the social conservative's pick. He's solidly conservative. He's written strong defenses of gun rights, but he has a working class background, which brings a fresh perspective to the court. He drove a cab to pay for college and law school, which people really like about him. He went to Notre Dame and Georgetown Law School, which would be a fresh perspective on the court. And I think you know, that would be a nice pick. And he's right now number fourth on the list, if you believe the reporting. He hasn't campaigned for the job. He hasn't lobbied for the job. He doesn't have Team Hardiman out there the way the others do, which is not necessarily their own doing, but he's kind of the outsider in this game, and that's a little refreshing.
And Amy Coney Barrett?
Well, she's apparently the president's second choice. She's 46 years old, extremely conservative. She got into a tangle with, she's only been on the court less than a year. She was appointed by President Trump, Sixth Circuit, which is kind of an outside circuit for these purposes. Also not an Ivy Leaguer, so that's nice. I got to tell you a little tidbit about her, which I find very appealing. She has seven children, five biological children, two children adopted from Haiti. And her youngest biological child has special needs, and still she's this very impressive career woman. Putting that aside, exceptionally conservative. She got into a tangle with Dianne Feinstein, now rather famously, where Dianne Feinstein, Senator Feinstein, in her confirmation said, "The dogma seems to live strongly within you." I could just hear
people talk that way, but go on.
Oh, but Senator Feinstein does. But this made her darling of social conservatives, yeah, because
I think it became a T-shirt, didn't it?
It did. Hashtag dogma strongly. But the dogma does seem to live strongly within her. At the same time, she insisted in the hearing, look, a judge should not put her personal views in her opinions. They should be separate. She refused to answer, though, whether or not she believes in the right for women to have an abortion. So there are a lot of questions about how she would rule on Roe v. Wade. The other judges have all tiptoed around that. The court is oddly, I've always found this fascinating, most analysts do, the court is oddly Catholic. Catholics seem to become Supreme Court justices. I guess it's all that rigorous thinking, all that Latin. And she is Catholic. And very much so, but she did say in her confirmation hearing that should not influence her views. At the same time, she refused to answer about Roe versus Wade, as they all do, right, as they all do. But the social conservatives are very much behind her, very excited about her, and she is only 46 years old, and President Trump has said he wants someone up there who can sit for decades. He doesn't want to think about this again, at least not with regard to this particular seat.
Okay, we're going to take...
There is a thought I want to say that he might hold her in reserve for one of the women, in particular Ruth Bader Ginsburg, one of those seats, as if there's a female seat, right, and an African-American seat. But that is the suggestion.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a minute with WNYC's Jamie Floyd, and we'll take some of your calls after the break. Stay with us. I'm Nancy Solomon, managing editor for New Jersey Public Radio, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. If you're joining us now, I'm speaking with WNYC's Jamie Floyd. She's the host of All Things Considered and our resident legal analyst. Listeners, what questions do you have about how the nomination process for the upcoming vacancy on the Supreme Court will go? Give us a call at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And we've got lots of folks who want to ask you questions, Jamie. So
it's the best part, Nancy.
Let's go to Tom in Morris County. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hello, Ms. Solomon. Well done representing Jersey in the big chair.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Floyd.
Jersey, baby.
Yeah, baby. My question is there a law, rule, or guideline preventing us from trying to balance the court by mandating four conservatives, four progressives, and the Chief Justice being the deciding vote?
Good question.
Yeah, that's great. A great question. It's all in the U.S. Constitution, Article 3, but there's not a whole lot there. So, no, there is no law, guideline, or mandate, and it would have to be reinserted, if you will, by constitutional amendment. It's actually a great suggestion, but it's all really in the hands of the president and the Senate, as Nancy suggested earlier, advise and consent. It's really the balance of powers amongst the three branches of government. So the president makes the nomination, the Senate is supposed to advise and consent, and then the court goes about its business with that lifetime appointment, which many people criticize. I actually like the lifetime appointment because I think it allows a justice to evolve over time, and we've seen many judges do that. They become very different from the person they were when first nominated. But there is no requirement of a balance, as you suggest. There is, of course, there are the 9 seats so that you have the tiebreaker, although we have functioned with 8 justices, as we did very recently after Justice Scalia passed away.
Thanks for your question, Tom. And, you know, politicians like to say elections have consequences. And we're feeling that one right now. Let's go to another call. Steve in Westchester. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for picking me up. Actually, I have a little disagreement with Jamie, and I have a disagreement with all our Democrats that are sort of throwing their hands up and saying, well, you know, there's nothing we can do. We can't wait. I think what really needs to be done is a Mitch McConnell type of strategy, which is tell the Gang of Three, which is Manchin and McCaskill and I forget the third. Susan Collins, thank you. Just to vote no on every nominee that comes up until we get to the point where Donald Trump has to nominate somebody that's more agreeable or more of a compromise nominee than what he's putting up there now. Mitch McConnell was able to hoodwink everybody and stall and run out the clock. And the Democrats should start doing that. I don't think we need to say, well, you know, we'll see how it goes. Because my point, my view is whoever gets selected is a multi-generational nominee who will be conservative for a couple of decades at least versus Senate elections that come up every 2 years. And in 2020, there are going to be 33 seats up for election. 20 of them will be Republican. So my point is, you make the stand now, and you win back the seats, but this is where the stand needs to be. And that's my view.
Well, how long would you run out the clock?
Run out the clock as long as I can. Mitch McConnell ran out as long as he did. You know, we try to play by the rules, and this president has thrown the rules out. And I think we need to go, you know, eye for an eye. I really believe that. You know, we try to be the party that holds a higher ground, and we are the party that holds a higher ground. But when it's time to make a fight, we have to make a fight. It's like what happened in Normandy. You need to sacrifice at the beaches, and now is the time to sacrifice at the beaches.
I don't disagree with that. I would simply point out that sometimes you can't really predict with Supreme Court justices. So David Souter turned out to be a great disappointment for the liberals, as did Earl Warren, who was appointed, I will remind you, by Dwight Eisenhower and turned out to be the greatest liberal justice the country has ever seen. In fact, the greatest liberal chief justice the country has ever seen. He shepherded the Warren Court through, I don't have to name the opinions for you, Brown versus Board of Education, Loving versus Virginia, Miranda, and he was appointed by a Republican president and to the great dismay of many Republicans thereafter and conservatives thereafter. So I don't always buy into the labeling of justices. Sometimes they do turn out to be precisely what we expect, as Clarence Thomas has, and as I think Justice Alito will. But sometimes they surprise us because they have that lifetime appointment.
But I think the caller really gets at some of the despair and the anger among Democrats about this, and the fact that they want to see their party stand up and fight by, you know, fight whether they fight
any means necessary.
Yeah. I think that's more to the point, is just what people are wanting. So is there a play for the Democrats to make?
That's the political process. I mean, I have to say the Trump White House is so incredibly disorganized, dysfunctional. More people have left this White House in the first year and a half than I think we've seen in any administration. But if there is one place they are incredibly well organized, it is in this process. And this is the one place the Democrats do seem to be less functional and less well-organized than this Trump White House. I mean, they have their deputy communications director, Raj Shah, focused only on this. He stepped out to focus only on this. The Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society have been seating these judges for 30 years. It doesn't matter which Republican is in the White House, Trump or anybody else, these judges have been getting ready since I was in law school. I mean, I remember the Federalist Society when I was in law school. And these people have been preparing for this moment for 30 years. So the Trump White House, functional or dysfunctional, this process is working. So the caller, speaking for Democrats is correct. If they want to get a process going and work by the Mitch McConnell playbook, need to get organized and decide who they're going to be. The question is, to what end? To what end? What is the end game, given who is in the White House and for how long? And the fact that the court could theoretically function with eight justices for a very long time. So it's not really about the Supreme Court. It's about what happens in the Senate and how what the process will be for forestalling this nomination.
I want to try to squeeze in more calls before we run out of time. We have Linda in Princeton, New Jersey. Hi, Linda. You're on
getting
the air.
All your New Jersey callers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hi, Jamie and Nancy. Question for Jamie. I read up on Coney Barrett, and she belongs, aside from being, I assume, a devout Roman Catholic, she belongs to a charismatic evangelical sect within the church,
yes.
I believe, called People for Praise or
Correct.
Praise for People.
People for Praise.
Okay. And one of the things that struck me, and I'm an agnostic, so all of this is inside baseball to me, the duality, it says in that women, married women, are supposed to cleave to the judgment or the counsel of their husbands in moral and ethical and, I assume, religious matters. So she is in a unique position on the court. I believe she's the only spouse who will have to defer to her own spouse's judgment, possibly. That seems to me rather alarming.
Well, I don't know a whole lot about People for Praise.
People of Praise.
People
it.
Of
it's
Praise.
Alarming.
Yeah, I'm looking. Christian community, families, and single people who seek to participate in the mission of the church in our time and to live our lives communally until the day Jesus will be all in all.
Right.
It's an interesting question because she clearly is a career woman. I mean, having, done a lot of scholarly writing and
right.
been appointed to this position on the Court of Appeals, which is, no joke
yeah.
for legal
but Jamie,
people.
If she ultimately has to, according to this group, defer to her husband,
well,
women are second-class citizens, just like in many religions, not right. the major ones necessarily. If she must defer not only to her God, but to her husband, I don't see where that puts her on the court. I mean, she might have to recuse herself endlessly, more than most people would on the court. I don't know. Anyway, that's my question.
The reading that I've done suggests that maybe there's been a bit of exaggeration in the description of this group, as concerning as it is, and that their website sort of fights the characterization, and I saw a piece in the Wall Street Journal that said that this is overblown, and they did call the women handmaidens, but then when it became associated with Handmaid's Tale, they dropped that word.
Well, there also would be the question of how involved she is with the group, and there has long been a question in our country, going back to John Kennedy's election as president, how involved are you as a religious person in your religion, in your affiliation with the religion? How much does the dogma of your faith affect your public persona and your public service? And I think she should be asked all of those questions in her confirmation hearing. And she has been somewhat directly asked those questions by Dianne Feinstein, but she would have to, certainly, if she's going to have a lifetime appointment on the U.S. Supreme Court, be asked those questions very pointedly in her confirmation hearing for that seat. One would hope President Trump has asked some of those questions, but we can't be confident of that.
Well, and speaking of questions, I just threw about 15 of them on the floor because we've run out of time. That is it for us, Jamie, as much as I would love to talk to you more about this. Jamie Floyd is WNYC's All Things Considered host and our resident legal analyst. Thanks so much for coming in early.
My pleasure, Nancy.